Segrin. I will try to remember to call her commissioner. And with her, Mr. Tom Melcher. And, you know, she kept this very well hidden, but you see there's a little addition up there with her. And when you want relief, I might help you out.
Are you ready, Chris, to start?
Yes. Why don't you just go ahead? People will be coming in pretty rapidly now, I think.
Well, what we want to do, I'm going to just kind of tee this up for you all today. And you've got a PowerPoint that we're going to be working off of. And I just wanted to kind of let you know what's the kind of the large broad parameters for the governor's budget is, and then Tom and I will kind of go back and forth between the finance and some of the policy issues. As you know, the governor probably does have four main components of his budget. The first one is the proposal to put 2 and 2 on the formula, 2% and 2% on each in each year of the biennium. The second area that he has a proposal for is the QCOM proposal, and that is proposing $10 million in 06 and $50 million in 07 approximately for the QCOM proposal, and that is the reform measure to look at a different way of compensating teachers in the future. And then the third thing is the high school initiative, where he would propose, first of all, if a student took a college-level course in high school in either their junior or their senior year, that they would be able to then take a CLEP test. And a CLEP test is a test that is available already that many pre-college students can take to receive credit for coursework that they have taken. And we would propose to pay for the low-income folks. He wants to say hello. Look at him. Thank you. This is Tim Strom's baby, by the way.
Oh,
yes. And he's giving us a smile, too. Look at that. Yeah. We would propose to pay for any low-income student with a CLEP test, and then others would pay for it themselves. The test costs about $50, and I think there's a little bit of a finance, little. The other initiative would be the Advanced Placement IB program. And that program would also, if a student had a 3 or better on their student exam, would. I couldn't bounce fast enough. The AP or IB program, if you had a 3 or better on your test, you would get college credit for that. And then the other component is to look at, we have most of our students when they're going into college take the ACT test. And the ACT folks were in our office probably 2 or 3 months ago when our ACT scores were announced. And they have a program called EPASS. And EPASS has what I call 2 pre-tests that students can take, 1 in 8th grade and 1 in 10th grade, where it's kind of an assessment of where you're at in regard to your potential for doing well on the ACT. So the governor is proposing to pay for students taking the EPASS, the 8th grade, and the plan test, that's what they call the temporary test, to kind of give the kids a signal or an assessment of where they are in preparing for college. And there's 2 things that happen with that. You can, if you take it in 8th grade, you can also have an idea whether a student really needs some remediation and or whether they're really on target or if they're off track. Or the other thing that happens is it often be an indication that they're doing well and will help them plan for the coursework that they need to take for their post-secondary opportunities. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to go to a 4-year college. It does really give them an indication of how well they are prepared for any kind of post-secondary opportunity. So those would be paid for. Now, all of these things are optional things that school districts can do. Many schools already use the 10th grade plan test and are actively helping their students. this would also provide them some opportunity to go down to the eighth grade. So we've got kind of three components, the AP, the CLEP, and the kind of the pre-test that align to the ACT, that we think will really kind of start raising the rigor of high school opportunities. And the other day I was at Humboldt High School, and I was visiting with two seniors. They were my tour guide for the high school, and I asked them what they were going to be doing for their senior year, and they kind of smiled and said, well, we've got, you know, a couple of classes we're both going to take in the first trimester, but then after that they were going to kind of just be doing some stuff around the high school. And I said, what do you mean doing stuff around the high school? Well, we're done with all of our graduation requirements, so we really don't have to be here in school that much. They'll be hanging around, they'll be doing some extracurricular stuff, doing some things with their teachers. And you know, that's kind of, I wouldn't call it wasted time for them, but it's opportunity where they could be taking some coursework and building up credits that they could have then out of the way when they go to college. And that happened to my daughter when she was in high school to her 12th grade year. So lots of kids really don't, you know, take advantage fully of their 12th year. So we're hoping that that will help. And then the last component of the governor's budget is in the area of finance reform. And the governor had a finance task force a couple of years ago, or maybe it was about a year and a half ago, I guess. And they kind of examined the basic cost of an elementary and a high school and looked at the components. They didn't come up, they had a range of information, but part of the recommendations were to make sure that you had base funding and that you made sure that you had other formulas that address the demographic and geographic needs of our state, which we do already. But we want to make it more transparent and understandable to the public, and that was also part of the process and the recommendations. So what the governor is doing is proposing kind of a first step in this finance reform, and the proposal is to have every kid weighted the same. A kid is a kid, except for the kindergarten kids, which would be a half because they go half a day to school. But every other kid will be weighted as a one. However, what he does do is then recognize that there are some secondary costs, and he converts that cost to a per pupil amount. And I'm not going to start getting into all the details because then I'll steal Tom's thunder here. But he does propose to look at delinking all the formulas that have been linked to our general ed formula for purposes of understandability and transparency for the public. And to get rid of the Wadhams, the Madhams, and the Radhams, and the whatever. Because as you're going out and you're trying to explain that to the public, and, well, this is based on the resident marginal cost unit, or this is based on the, you know, the Wadhams, the weighted adjusted marginal cost units, and it just gets very, very complicated. And then he does propose that in all those categoricals, that there would be a 2% formula increase on those each year, the biennium also. But he just proposes to delink those. So I'm not going to go into any more detail, but those are kind of the four big components of the governor's budget for this year. And so, Tom, why don't you take it over, and you can start with kind of the financial details.
Thank you.
Mr. Melcher, welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'm going to be walking through the PowerPoint presentation along with the Commissioner. We'll discuss the changes the Governor is proposing in the general education program and categorical programs, some other policy changes that are being proposed, and then finally talk about some of the bottom line fiscal impacts. For the first year of the biennium, the governor is recommending a 2% increase in the general education formula. There is no major restructuring of the formulas until the second year of the biennium. So the formula would increase from $4,601 currently to $4,693. We would still be using adjusted marginal cost pupil units in the first year of the biennium, and that's a $92 increase per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit. It's equivalent to about $100 per unweighted student, and we'll be converting to unweighted students in the second year of the biennium. The governor is also recommending two other important changes in the first year of the biennium. The first is to provide a transition levy for pre-kindergarten programs that had previously been funded in fiscal year 04 and earlier years. And the ones that you hear about the most are the High Five program in Minneapolis, the community kindergarten program in St. Paul, but there are also a number of other programs scattered around the state that are similar, that provided pre-kindergarten services for four-year-olds or in some cases five-year-olds that weren't ready for kindergarten. The governor would do is allow districts to make a transition levy for those programs for a four-year period, fiscal 06, 07, 08, 09. And the funding would be partly aid, partly levy. It would be equalized the same as the first tier of the referendum. This is the same kind of proposal that the governor made last year to provide transition funding for these programs, except that this one begins in fiscal 06 now instead of beginning in fiscal 05. In addition to that, the governor is recommending that we provide compensatory revenue for Hmong refugees arriving after October 1st, 2004, before March 15th of 2005. Funding for compensatory education is based on the free and reduced lunch count on October 1st of the prior school year. So that normally a district's compensatory funding for fiscal 06 would be based on their free and reduced lunch count on October 1st, 2004. However, we have a large number of Hmong immigrants from a refugee camp in Thailand who are arriving in this country after October 1st, and without a change in law, they would not receive funding for those students during fiscal 06. This would provide that funding during fiscal 06, and then in fiscal 07, they would automatically be counted as part of the normal process.
Mr. Melcher, is it all right if we just interrupt with questions when we have them?
Madam Chair, that would be
Representative Heidgerken, do you have one at this point?
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. Transition levy for the pre-K programs. My understanding that this was about 85% metro in the past.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgerken, I would say that's probably accurate. I haven't done the calculations, but I know the two largest programs were in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We know there are also programs in Robbinsdale and in Hopkins. We know there was a program in Bemidji that was pretty good size. So I would say probably at least 85% metro. And I haven't run the numbers on it, but that sounds reasonable.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up.
Has
the governor thought about, in my area, we have a great influx of Hispanics, creating basically the same problem in education that the Hmong would be will create. But we have a ton of them that are moving into my area and to represent Junkies District as well, and we have the same problems. Has there been any thought given to that? The fastest element of population growth in our area, Hispanics.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair and Representative Heidgerken, no, there was no discussion about other minority or cultural groups moving into the state of Minnesota. We knew that there were going to be a large influx concentrated in one or two areas of the state that we wanted to prepare for, and that was why we did this. Certainly, if there were other, you know, indications that a large group of people were coming from a refugee camp and needed that support, I think that there would be, you know, those considerations. But I think this was a very unusual situation where you had, a very large group of people that were going to be arriving in a very short period of time, refugees with lots of issues versus maybe Hispanic or other folks coming in that maybe coming from actually a more stable environment than these actual students would be coming from.
Are there further questions? Representative Bernardi.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the, can you go back to that last slide, regarding the pre-K programs, particularly Bemidji. Was that funded by a levy before, or was that funded through aid? How was that funded in 04?
Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, during fiscal year 2004, these school districts reported the students as kindergarten students, and they were included in the regular pupil count for the school district and funded through the basic general education formula, which is funded entirely with state aid.
Madam Chair, a follow-up.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to bring it to the attention of the Commissioner and our committee. I know Bemidji, when they passed their recent local levy, they made a commitment to their voters that they wouldn't do any more discretionary levies. And so for them, this, as I understand it, this would not help that school district because they made a commitment that they wouldn't do these types of transitional levies. So that's something that we need to look into because this may not even help them at all. Does that make sense to you?
Madam
Mr. Melcher.
Representative Bernardi, I'm not entirely familiar with the situation in Bemidji, but I believe what they did was to say that there was going to be an offset of some of their other existing miscellaneous levies to offset the amount of the additional referendum that they were passing. I'm not sure if they made a commitment about any future ones. I don't know for sure.
Mr. Melcher, I have one question with this compensatory revenue for the Hmongs. There was a little newscast the other night that talked about the tuberculosis over there in those camps, and there's a moratorium. So I assume this money would be paid when they start to show up, or how is this going to work?
Madam Chair and members, the language that we have drafted at this point in the bill would call for a second count to be made on March 15th. Earlier, the St. Paul School District had written a letter to the commissioner and requested that we do a count on February 15th, and it was moved back a month due to the tsunami, actually, where we had identified that there were problems getting the people moved out of the camps because the airplanes were being used for disaster relief. So currently we're looking at a March 15th date. I'm not sure about the impact that this latest tuberculosis issue would have on whether March 15th would still be an appropriate date or whether we would need to revisit that maybe a little later when we find out exactly what's happening with that.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions right at this moment? Seeing none, would you please go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next slide discusses the issues of formulas being delinked and inflated. As the commissioner mentioned, the compensatory sparsity, transportation sparsity formulas would be delinked from the general education formula, but they would be inflated as if they had been linked. So there would be a 2% increase in the compensatory sparsity and transportation sparsity formulas for fiscal 06 and an additional 2% increase in fiscal 07. But in future bienniums, it would require an act of the legislature to continue to provide that inflation that wouldn't automatically be provided as the formula was increased. The other recommendation on this page is that the governor is recommending to repeal the January 15th deadline, contract deadline, and penalty.
Representative Heidgerken has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a very difficult time with the delinking of especially the transportation sparsity out my district. There are some school districts that run along, you know, do a lot of miles. And I know that is one area in which they were able to gain some equity. How would it affect a school district, say, that's getting as much as $1,300 per pupil on sparsity aid? Now we delink it.
Mr. Melcher.
Chair and Representative Heidgerten, in the governor's budget, there's a 2% increase provided in the transportation sparsity money the first year, another 2% increase provided the second year. With the delinking, when you came back in 2007 to talk about what the changes would be at that time, it's anticipated that there would then be a discussion about what's happening in terms of transportation costs. Are they growing at the same rate as inflation generally, or is there a higher rate of inflation or a lower rate of inflation? What's the latest information about transportation? And then there would be a separate decision made about should that be inflated at the same rate as the formula, at a higher rate or at a lower rate. And I think the idea was to ensure that there was a more substantive discussion on the merits of increasing each of those formulas individually and how those formulas relate to the individual costs, especially as there may be further analysis being done in terms of the actual expenditures for different kinds of services and better data becoming available.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, it does seem to pick up on Representative Heidgerken's concern that certainly districts have experienced more than a 2% increase in transportation costs, just looking at the increase in gasoline and diesel prices over the last couple of years. The 2% that the governor is recommending doesn't meet inflation to begin with, let alone inflation on transportation. I'm concerned then that the delinking of these items kind of tends to bury them and force us to deal with them in out years as opposed to ensuring that school districts receive the revenue that we recognize that they need in other areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Segrin. And you responded.
Just call me Alice. Whether it was linked or de-linked, if we had a 2% increase on the formula, what would have happened automatically is the transportation sparsity would have gotten a 2% increase on the formula. That's the only change. What we're saying is that in the future, you have all of your categories, and it's very clear exactly how much per pupil you're getting for transportation sparsity or whatever the category is that's been de-linked. But if there's no change, if we would have linked, if the formula went up 2%, that would have gone up 2%. It's not a reflection of whether that was adequate to meet the transportation sparsity program. It's just a matter of making it now more transparent to the public so that you can go out and say, here's what our general education formula is, here's what our transportation sparsity per pupil is, here's what ... is, and you can actually really have the public understand what it is, and then you can have that discussion. Right now, you don't have that discussion about is this an adequate formula. It just goes up at whatever the formula is, but you never get into the cost, you know, you never get into even analyzing whether the formulas that drive these are appropriate for the 21st century or appropriate for the needs of our schools anymore. And that's why I was saying in my introductory remarks, the governor is actually proposing this to be the first step in really looking at how we analyze what's going on in our schools and really start having those discussions. So that all that's doing is putting that out there much more transparently to the public, and it's more understandable, frankly, than trying to explain this general formula. And some school districts get 4601, but some get 5263 because they get this, this, and this, and people, and they get, you know, resident. I can't even. Resident cost, marginal pupil, and marginal cost, and declining pupil and stuff, and so it just becomes very confusing as to why does this district get this, why does this district get that. You just have a basic formula, and then every kid or every district gets this because they get this transportation, they get this compensatory for kids, etc. So that's the only reason that we're doing it that way.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher, could you remind me what percentage
Representative
of
Dabney.
Districts in the state receive compensatory aid, roughly?
Madam Chair and Representative
Mr. Melcher,
I think all of the school districts in the state receive some compensatory aid, with the exception of Prinsburg and Franconia, which don't have any kids. But there is quite a wide variation in the concentration of poverty across the state and the amount of money per student that's generated.
I'm tempted, Madam Chair,
Representative Dabney,
ask how much money districts that don't have any kids get, but I'm not going to.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the issue of delinking, I think maybe one of the reasons that it was linked was to ensure that some schools weren't left behind, that in fact the costs of sparsity, the cost of transportation are increasing in the rural districts, and just to make sure that that adequate funding was provided, I think, that was that one of the justifications for having it linked, and isn't there a danger in delinking it, that you're not going to have the increases necessary to adequately fund the increasing transportation needs of rural schools? I guess I really have a concern about that, that it might be, if there's going to be cuts in education, it's going to come out of those categorical aids, and so the schools located in the more remote parts of rural Minnesota, like the ones I represent, could end up being left behind.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner Siegman.
I guess Representative Eakin and I don't see it that way. I see the fact that, you know, all we're doing is dividing your expenditures out so that people can see, you know, what districts get. And so some districts are going to get transportation sparsity, some are going to get other things, but we need to have, you know, that's why we have the categoricals, or that's why we have the additions, because we have unique geographic needs, we have unique demographic needs, and that's actually what the recommendation was from the task force, that those things be recognized and be out there as recognized costs. And I think it's very important that the public understand those and you have that clear discussion that these are important things to be doing. And that's why the governor said, you know, 2% across the board is what we want to do. That's what we would have done with it linked or delinked. And that's what, you know, that's the philosophy behind it. But I don't see that it would be a threat to your areas, because you need it. You need the transportation spart operating money, and you need transportation sparsity and the operating sparsity monies because of your unique needs. Now, you may want to look at the formulas. You may want to say the formulas themselves that are driving the money need to be upgraded. You know, there are a lot of things you can look at that never are discussed, actually. They're just kind of on automatic pilot. And I think that's why the governor's saying, you know, let's put these out there. And then if there needs to be some adjustments internally with some of these, you need to have that discussion. And I haven't for 12 years. I've been here. Everything's just been there, and nobody really has realized the importance of some of these things and had that serious discussion.
Representative Eakin, quite honestly, in the last few years, we have increased equity. We have increased declining enrollment. We have increased revenue equity. You know, I don't think that there's too much danger that we're going to forget we have rural parts in Minnesota.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just concerned, I guess, that you know, if it's delinked, there's going to be, it'll always be a struggle to try to justify increasing the spending for these categorical aids that continue to increase in costs. And I guess I don't know if it's possible to have it indexed or somehow to actually reflect. It doesn't seem like that would take away from the discussion about what the needs are or what the true costs are. If you had it indexed, that would generate just as much discussion, I would think, as far as the actual costs of these, the sparsity aid and transportation sparsity and compensatory.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative
Siegman,
there are lots of ways you could do this. You could say a percentage of the formula instead of, you know, whatever, a dollar amount. So there are different ways to do it, but I think the governor's philosophy is that they need, he's trying to make the whole system more transparent and understandable for people, so that everybody gets X amount for the general fund, and then you have all these other categories, and some districts are eligible for these, and some are eligible for these, and you add all those up, and this is the per pupil amount, and you don't have all of this other entwining of formulas that get very confusing to the public. So there are ways to do it.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, it did seem to me that that we still would have the complexity, and so there would still be the challenge of understanding it, that we're not going to get rid of the discussion of this district gets 4601 plus they get such and such percentage for compensatory or the sparsity, those all still exist, and so the complexity of explaining why one district gets a different amount than another would occur, whether it was linked or delinked, because the programs are still there, I would think. So I'm not convinced in my own mind that at the end of the day it's much clearer. The question is then, is it the thought that each of these categories then may be funded at different inflation rates, that if transportation costs went up by 4% when the general inflation rate was 3%, that we would be then dealing with applying different inflation rates to these categories? Is that part of what the delinking is about? Trying to have multiple inflation rates for different categories? Would that be the end result of this?
Commissioner Stephen. Madam Chair, I don't know, Representative Dorn, if you'd even want to call it inflation rates, but you, because the way we look at it, the 2% is equivalent to X per pupil, you know, dollar amount. That's what the discussion should be about. If you have some of those internal formulas that might need more, currently the way it works, if your formula goes up 2%, then that goes up 2%, and there's never any discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this would cause that discussion to happen, and then you could adjust those, and maybe some you don't. Maybe some you keep flat because you feel like you've reached really a maximum amount of money that you should be putting into, you know, into it, and there's no real cost effectiveness anymore of continuing to increase, or maybe you're having some kind of adverse reaction to it. I mean, that it's causing things that you don't want to have to happen because you continue funding things the way you are. So I think you should have that discussion, and that would be your discussion every legislative session, to look at those formulas and decide. And when you talk about the complexity, I don't think that we're ever going to get away we're never going to have a simple formula where everybody is going to get $6,000 per pupil, and then you just spend it the way you want, because we have recognized that there are at-risk kids, there are sparsity needs, there are equity needs, there are a lot of different things, so, and declining pupils. So you're going to have those, but the complex, it's not as complex if you don't have all of these weightings and linkages and things that kind of distort and are hard to explain. If you've got a basic formula and you have the different things that we have said as a state are important to recognize, that's much more easier to explain than to have everything with weightings and madams and wadams and radams, etc. So I think it does make it much more understandable to the public. You can really go out and say, my district gets 4601, everybody does in the state. My district also gets sparsity, and my district also gets compensatory. And here's the amount, and here's what it adds up to. And so this is our revenue, and then here's how we're going to spend it.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative
Mike and Commissioner, I would hope, you know, this time around that we certainly make sure we have the kind of discussion you're talking about. In my mind, whether we're talking about increases that are linked or delinked, we should be looking at the adequacy of the 2% inflation proposal, you know, that the governor has put forth, and the adequacy of 2% on these different categories in the context of, you know, the funding that we have or have not been able to do in the last few years. So I hope this committee has, you know, a really thorough discussion of all of those dollars and where they land, just because I think we, you know, we've tried to have that, and we should have that. No matter if we start with a proposal that happens to be linked or one that isn't linked, I hope we have a good discussion on the dollars that are needed throughout the budget. So,
Representative Beacon.
Yeah, I just want to.
Pardon me, Representative Meslow was next. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either way, I'm actually just listening to the fears and to the advantages, and I want to make sure that I'm understanding them correctly. So, Commissioner Seegren, if you'd if you tell me whether I'm tracking this correctly, I want to make sure I'm on with this. It seems to me in the short term, as we're talking about the upcoming biennium, there are only upsides, because what we do by delinking is we make it very clear, very easy for us to understand and explain why different districts get different amounts. And the governor's proposal is for a 2% increase in all of the categories, so nobody's coming out ahead or behind in this current biennium by delinking, as opposed to maintaining the current linking in the 2%. All we're doing is getting a little more understandable in what we're doing. Is that right so far?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So as I'm listening to the argument, I understand both the fear and the advantages are when we look past that biennium. The fears I'm hearing are that districts that are particularly dependent on these other categories could be affected if we say, if future legislatures and governors were to say, well, we're going to put our focus on the per pupil formula because that's the one everybody pays attention to, and some other categories potentially could suffer for that, and that's the fear that I'm hearing around the table. On the other hand, what I see is the advantages, the ongoing transparency, and the opportunity to say, just because we anticipate that the classroom expenses are going up by X percent, that doesn't mean the transportation expenses are going up by the same percent. It may be more, it may be less, and we have the opportunity to have more discussions about those numbers and to break those down independently. And that's what I see as the advantage of the governor's proposal. Am I tracking?
Yes, you are.
All right.
Representative.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Eakin.
I just wanted to reiterate what Representative Dorn was saying. I still don't understand why we can't have that conversation even when it's linked. We certainly can still break down what's being spent on transportation sparsity and compensatory without doing the delinking. It seems to me that one of the results of this is just going to be, it's going to make it harder for schools like those out in rural Minnesota to get the sparsity aid and the transportation sparsity that they need, because it's going to be a struggle to every time come back and try to fight for any increase that's necessary to cover the expenses. So it seems that the primary result won't be to simplify. What it's going to be is to make it more difficult for schools that depend on a lot of these categorical aids. Just an observation.
All right, I think we should move on.
Madam Chair, the next slide is in regard to the governor's proposal for QComp, and that is the a different way of paying teachers. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, there is $10 million for 06 and about another $50 million in 07. He proposes to grow it, and we've had the question, why 10 and then 50? And we know that schools and teachers won't be really starting their negotiations until after this legislative session is over. So we do know that there probably will be a few districts that will be interested in moving into the QComp program because we've had the inquiries already, and they've actually been waiting, kind of, we've had the old pilot, and they've been interested in becoming part of the old pilot. So that's kind of the reason we're kind of hoping to gear up. The $10 million will cover about 9% of the students in the state. And I want to make clear that students, not districts. And the reason why we don't say districts is it's hard to anticipate, you know, what size districts might want to come in. So we kind of are expressing it that way. In the 07 year, it would cover about 50% of the students in the state to go into the program. It's proposed to be a categorical program that would have a funding going forward that would be guaranteed. It would not be a pilot where people would be worrying about whether it was going to continue, so that once the program is negotiated, the districts would be guaranteed to receive that money in perpetuity. There are four principles in the proposal. The first one is multiple career paths. In other words, you provide a master, mentor, the career teacher, and the probationary or beginning teacher paths in the teaching area. Also, there will be what I'm most excited about is the kind of just-in-time ongoing professional development that's linked to personal goals, to site and district goals that happens during the school day and during the school week. Not the going to an in-service or a class after school when you're tired or early or during the summertime, but where you're really talking about strategies and professional development that are aligned to what you need to be doing in your building and in your district and professionally in a personal way. And then the third thing would be an evaluation component where every teacher would be evaluated at least 3 to 6 times during the year on their goals that they have set that are aligned to their personal goals and to the site and district goals. And then the fourth thing would be some compensation would be tied to your impact as a teacher on the classroom and your academic achievement or the impact that you have on academic achievement of your students. If not all of it, and I want to emphasize that there's been, I think, some misperception about that this is all going for bonuses. That's really actually a very small portion of what we're using the money for, proposing to use the money for. The largest portion of the money is to restructure your compensation system to pay for those master teachers that would be spending some portion of their time of the day in the classroom, but the other portion of their time actually working with their colleagues in modeling best practices for the classrooms and for the mentor teacher to be working with other teachers that are beginning the profession and to cover them with additional staff, and then also for substitutes and people to come in while teachers are actually meeting in their professional development groups during the day or week. So that's where the majority of the money is being expended to kind of restructure actually the way you're doing things during the week and during your year. And then there is a portion that would be negotiated actually to be spent the way you want to in rewarding teachers our buildings for their goals that they have achieved. And last night we were down in Owatonna, and the Waseca folks came to present, and you were down there, and I think you all had that presentation. We had Marshall down there, too, talking about they were one of the original pilots and talking about their compensation system. So we had a really good discussion last night. So you've had a lot of exposure to this. I know you went down, so I'm not going to belabor the point anymore. But that is kind of the philosophy and framework that the governor wishes to pursue as we go forward.
Commissioner, in the budget, you also have alternative compensation in addition to the QCOM at $3.7 million. Is that just for the current programs, the 4 or 5 that are out there?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that is rolled in to the existing program. So we would anticipate that the people that are in the pilots now would be transitioning to the new program. But we are still kind of working out the details with that. So, but it is incorporated into the total amount of money. And Mr. Melcher, if you can give us the figures.
I'll explain that a little bit now,
okay.
Chair.
Yeah.
Representative Erickson, before we move on. Thank you, Chair Sikora. Before we leave this, Commissioner, the alignment of the set-aside on staff development, will that be dependent on what the districts have set aside, or is there going to be a requirement, 2%, 1%, any discussion about that? Because I'm asked that question when I'm out with my school board.
I think maybe are we confusing the staff development money with the alternative comp money?
Well, Madam Chair, it reads align staff development plan and set aside. So is that different, Commissioner, from present set aside?
Right. I'm sorry, I wasn't following you there for a minute.
I wasn't either.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the purpose would be to, the 2% set aside that is now in existence for districts to staff development that money, that usage of that money would also be aligned with, and it would make sense to do that, to, you know, really coordinate all of those activities, to focus everything on it. Because professional development is a really big key component of that, and to have, you know, some other kind of type of professional development when you're really focused on this would, you know, not make any sense.
So, Madam Chair and Commissioner Erickson, so to clarify then, the staff development dollars would be rolled into the alternative compensation program, no?
No, Madam Chair, no. The $225 is a separate appropriation, and then on top of that is whatever your 2% set aside is. So, no, it's but you are you know, there should be an alignment of your professional development dollars that you have to set aside with what you're doing with your 225.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question: do you have to have all your schools in your school district decide that they're going to do this type of program, alternative compensation, or the QComp? I know our school district passed 4 out of 5 of the schools agreed to it. And is that okay?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner,
and Representative Bernardi, under the old pilot, you could do a percentage of your teachers, you could do a site, or you could do a whole district. And I would anticipate that that's, you know, and right now, in fact, the TAP program has 3 sites in Minneapolis that are participating. Okay. So you could do it a number of ways.
Representative Dammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, wish I had a speech.
Pregnant pause or dramatic?
I wish I had a speech. I was going to ask a question, so I thought I'd wait. Commissioner, you mentioned about being in Owatonna and hearing some of the folks talking about TAP and the things that we heard down in Waseca this week. One of the most interesting comments that I heard is, and this was made by everybody from the superintendent to the master and mentor teachers and also the career teachers, ultimately to them, even though they started out by going into the TAP program because of the money, they independently said, turns out it's not about the money. Turns out it's about the professional development that they're feeling and what they're doing, and quite frankly, they would like to see the money. I think this is what I gathered, and I'd be interested in your comments if you heard this from Owatonna, and I think this is the place to say this, that they almost wish that instead of having this pot at the end of the rainbow for them, that they could be using it to bring in some help so that they had more time to spend together in their focus groups and that sort of thing. And it turned that they're, rather than having them get some sort of a bonus or something in their salary at the end, they'd almost prefer, they like the whole concept of what's going on there, but they would have liked it if that money could have been used maybe to get a little bit more help to give them more time to do this. And I found that very interesting, especially coming from all 3 different sectors, because as I don't know if you're aware, we had a chance to visit with them independently. The staff or the administration and the masters left and gave us a chance to visit with career teachers by themselves and vice versa, and it was independent comments. And did you gather that, Commissioner, from Owatonna, or have you heard similar things?
Madam Chair and Representative Dammer,
Commissioner.
I think it's probably a mixed bag on that. I think, in fact, we heard comments last night that, yes, you know, people were a little bit hesitant, you know, they weren't as warm to the idea of a performance and evaluation. That once they had, you know, been recognized and had been paid, the pay was actually pretty nice to be able to have a little additional money because you've really worked hard and you're recognized for that. In fact, there was a retired teacher that came up to me last night and said, you know, I considered myself just a really good teacher, and I would be really frustrated with a colleague that would be next door that had not done much, and it was frustrating that we were making the same amount of money. Now, he was, so I think that it's mixed on it, but there is nothing to preclude, a negotiation with management and teachers to say that you're going to have all of these principles in your agreement, and that any set-aside monies could be used to do group, you know, building types of things. That if you're building and your teachers as a group had met their goals for, you know, reading achievement or whatever, and you were then eligible for X bonus dollars, so to speak, there's nothing to say that you couldn't, you know, at an individual site, say we're going to, instead of you know, having each person having a bonus, you could just say that's going to go into a pool to give us more time for professional development. I personally think, though, that when teachers are working really hard and have been evaluated on objective criteria and have really done some stellar things, that they should be rewarded and compensated. It's not always about that plaque on the wall either, because I do think that that does incent people also. It's not everything. It's not the entire, and that's why I like this program. And it's not about, we're giving you a lot of money to be doing, you know, bonuses, and that's the entirety of the program, because it really is about professional development, evaluation, personal growth. It's really raising the industry to a really even higher level than it is now. And I, for 12 years, I've heard teachers saying we need to have more meaningful professional development. We need to have it in class, or, you know, during the day, when it's meaningful, when we need to be talking to our colleagues. So that's why I think it's so exciting.
Just Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow. I agree with you. I guess I wasn't advocating that we should change that. In fact, I would advocate that we need to keep that in there. Because I think at the end of the day, that really, as opposed to incentive, becomes the reward, and I think it's important. I just thought it was an interesting comment, and I think to me it indicated that we're on the right track here. And the idea about more time was not lost on my ears. I don't think the rest of the committee, something to look at as we evolve this program and think about how to go forward. But I wouldn't advocate again. I mean, I'm a capitalist for crying out loud, but I think we should be rewarded for those sorts of things, and I like that part of it, and I wasn't saying we shouldn't. I just thought that was an interesting interesting observation, and so I just want to make that clear. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Thorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in general, I had the same, I think, sense of what I heard down there as Representative Demmer. The distinction or the clarification that I'd make for sure is that I thought it that there was a lot of it was about the money, but it was the bulk of the money that went for the time that they had extra, the professional development time, having someone who could actually serve as the master or mentor teacher, that piece of it. The piece that didn't seem to be much about the money was the bonus component, and I figure we'll spend more time on that as it goes by. My quick question, and just in terms of all of the dollars, do we have the records or the information, does the department have, on the number of districts that have in the last few years found themselves in the position where they had to use their staff development funds to just pay the general bills, to pay some of the inflationary costs that weren't met? I believe in our district the last couple of times, by a vote, it was decided that those funds just had to be used for more of the basics. So I'm not sure, in terms of calculating the dollars available to do some of this, whether or not districts, you know, have already been put in such a financial bind that it would be difficult for them to find that money to do something new when they've been trying to do the basics. Do we know how many have used the staff development money for general budget purposes?
Madam Chair and Representative Dorn, I know that there is a professional development or staff development report, because I remember seeing it and actually showing the percentages, how much of a percentage of that the schools actually use for staff development, and I remember it ranged from about 1.5% to 4%. That was a couple of 3 years ago maybe that I saw that report. So we should be able to, that's required every year, so we should be able to go back and then see what percentage of the revenue is being expended by each of the districts in light of, you know, that we did provide a waiver for districts this year to give them a little breathing room. However, one of the things that we did discover last year because of the way the language is written in the staff development portion, you have to set aside 2%, and you have to set aside 2% every year. So you may not use up all of your staff development 1 year, so the rest has to be put in reserve. And there were some districts who were saying, we've got quite a lot of reserve here that's been built up over the years, but they couldn't tap into it. They just had to keep putting it into this reserve. So we're going to kind of try to clarify that. So they're, even though districts maybe had waived their staff development for a couple of years, they could have had some reserve in balance there that they could have fallen back on. So, but that's a good question, and we will try to find out, you know, as much as we can, that information for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the next slide describes the formula for the QCOMP program. The governor is recommending a funding formula that would provide $225 times the prior year enrollment of the school district, or if it was only specific sites within the district that were doing it, we would use the enrollment at those sites. This funding would be all aid for fiscal year 2006. The levy for that year has already been made by the school districts. This compares to the current alternative compensation formula, which is $150 per pupil enrolled. So it's a $75 increase over the current alternative compensation formula that we have for the five districts. There would be a statewide limit of $16.7 million in the first year, which covers 9% of the students in the state. And the way that you piece the numbers together, there's the $10 million of new appropriation money. There's the $3.7 million from the existing appropriation. And because this is part of the general education program, this would be funded with the 81.9% payments during the current year and the final payment the following year. So when you work through all of the numbers, basically you have $16.7 million available for programs in fiscal year 06. To move to the next slide, we do a transition, and now we're going to talk about the governor's recommendations for fiscal year 2007 general education revenue. And the governor is recommending some more significant changes in the structure of the general education formula for fiscal year 2007 that are intended to make the pupil accounting system and the basic formula calculations more understandable and transparent. And these changes include eliminating the grade level weightings that we currently use. We would also eliminate the marginal cost pupil units, which are the additional pupil units that are received by school districts with declining enrollment. Funding would be based on the unweighted current year average daily membership, except with kindergarten weighted at 0.5 to reflect the half-time service that's funded by the state. Another change would be to eliminate the aid adjustment for changes in teacher retirement association and public employee retirement association employer contribution rates. Back in 1984 and again in 1997, there were changes made in the Public Employee Retirement Association and statewide TRA employer contribution rates. The biggest change there was, I believe it was a 2.34% reduction in the employer contribution rate for TRA when that fund became solvent and had paid off a deficit in 1997. And since 1997, we have made a reduction to the school district's general education aid equal to that 2.34% of the salaries that the school district had for TRA members back in 1997. And as we move farther away from 1997, that information gets older and older. You have districts that have had declining enrollment where that number becomes a larger and larger amount per student every year. You have other districts that have grown quite a bit since then, and that's a relatively small number for them. So using this relatively old data from 1984 and from 1997 to make this adjustment creates some equity issues and also makes the formula lacking in transparency and understandability, because we have a front end where we're saying districts are receiving $4,601 per student. But as a rule, school districts don't actually receive $4,601 per student, because with the other hand, we're taking away, it's on statewide, it's about $47 million reduction currently. So it averages about $60 per actual students across the state that are actually being reduced. And the concept here would be to eliminate that separate adjustment, just come up with a formula that reflects the actual amount that we're providing and not say we're going to give you 46 to 1 and we're going to take away $60. We're just going to have one formula that's the actual amount that that school districts would actually receive.
Representative Demmer has a question. Oh, I'm sorry, Dabney.
We're often confused.
Whoa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions, Dr. Melcher. My understanding was the rationale for the pupil waiting was a recognition that, for instance, delivering science curriculum to an elementary student was cheaper than delivering science curriculum to a high school student where you needed beakers and chemicals and things soaked in formaldehyde, and there were costs associated with those. What's the rationale then for moving away from acknowledging those differential cost experiences?
Madam Chair and Representative
Mr. Melcher,
the rationale for moving away from the building those cost differences into the pupil accounting system is to make the system more transparent. But the governor's not recommending eliminating the cost differentials that are being provided for secondary education versus elementary education, or eliminating the cost differentials that are provided for declining enrollment. Rather, the governor is recommending that we provide a basic formula that's a fixed amount. It would be $5,188 for every elementary student and every secondary student. But then in addition to that, there would be a separate formula for secondary education, which would provide an additional $936 per secondary student, which is equivalent to an 18% adjustment for cost differences between elementary and secondary education. And the governor is also recommending that there be an additional $1,297 times the decline in average daily membership from the prior year, which is essentially equivalent to the 77-23 weighting of students. So the idea was to try to maintain those cost differentials approximately where they are today, but to fund those through a more transparent, separate funding system so that in the future, when you look at the allocation of general education aid to a district, you would see every kid's getting $5,188. If you're a declining enrollment district, you're going to get another $1,297 times the decline that you had from this year to last year. So you have a separate line item. You can see how much you're spending for decline or how much additional money is going out for that purpose. And the same with secondary education. It's just perhaps a little bit easier to explain that every kid's generating $5,188. We're providing an extra amount, which is a line item for declining enrollment. We're also providing an extra amount, which is, again, a separate line item, for the secondary education cost. And it avoids trying to roll those all up into a per-pupil calculation where, for some purposes, we may be using an unweighted average daily membership count. For other purposes, we're using a weighted count that also has additional pupils built in for prior year enrollment decline. It tends to create some confusion as to how many kids we're actually paying for here. We're trying to keep the cost differential but eliminate the confusion about how many kids we have.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
It's amazing how complicated adding clarity can be.
Have you ever tried to explain 7723 to people when they wanted to know what we did about declining enrollment?
I thought I'd done that successfully, but I guess...
I don't.
I guess the question for Dr. Melcher to try to drill down a little bit here is this proposed change, A, revenue neutral for the state, B, for districts, are there going to be winners and losers in this? And if there are, do we know who they are, and will you let us know?
Madam Chair and Mr. Melcher, on the 7723 marginal cost of pupil units converted to basically an extra 25% on the formula, there are some, I think, very modest changes there. It's very close to being the same. What we're doing is, instead of giving you a 23% adjustment on many formulas, we're providing a 25% adjustment on the basic formula. And so there will be some slight variations among districts, but we don't think that one's going to create a lot of change among districts. On the secondary education piece, the current structure, we provide a weight of 1.115 for grades 1 through 3, 1.06 for 4 through 6, and 1.30 for 7 through 12. And as you can see on the slide, the current ratio is about a 26% additional funding for secondary compared to the grades 4 through 6, about a 16% additional funding compared to grades K through 3. This is replacing that with an 18%.
You just lost your audience.
Well, versus versus K through 6. So there could be some changes in terms of the percentage of students at K through 3 versus 4 through 6 versus 7 through 12. Overall, this is structured so that the $936 or the 18% level was set up to be funded at a level that's a little higher than the ratio between K-3 and 7-12 now, a little lower than the ratio between 4-6 and 7-12 right now. I think if we were going to do a straight-up conversion, it would have been a little closer to 19% differential instead of an 18% differential. So there could be maybe up to a 1% kind of change for if a district had all of their kids at secondary as opposed to all of them at elementary. But again, I think the change here is very modest. The one place where you will have probably more significant changes is the elimination of the separate TRA adjustment and rolling that up into the formula. Now, for the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth school districts, they're not members of TRA, so they're not generating a benefit from that particular change. The governor has recommended a change in the equity formula, which largely neutralizes that piece of the change. But there are some significant differences among districts across the state in the TRA adjustment as a percentage of the total, and especially small rural districts that have declined a lot since 1997 tend to have a very high TRA adjustment per student because of the decline in enrollment, and also because they're quite often lower class sizes in some of those schools, although that's partly offset by lower salaries in those schools. Districts that have had a lot of growth in their enrollment, some of the outer ring suburbs may currently be seeing a smaller TRA reduction per student than some of the other districts. So there's a little bit more of a swing on the TRA piece than on the other piece. Now, I've done some analysis just looking at these three pieces, the TRA, the growth and decline, and the secondary. And if you put those together, and it's kind of a replacement for the basic formula as we know it today, the range is, at the low end, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are between 2.6 and 2.8% increase over current law. At the high end, the number is about a 5% increase over current law. The average is 4. The governor's recommended 2% the first year, 2% the second year, so it's about a 4% over current law in the second year of the biennium. So you have a range there of from just under 3% to maybe just over 5% in terms of the differential that you have from these changes by themselves. Now, for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, because of this change, we've also looked at the equity formula, and we'll be talking about that more in a little bit, but the equity formula has traditionally excluded Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth from qualifying for that revenue. And the loss from the TRA, or the relatively small increase, the 2.6 to 2.8% for those districts vis-a-vis the average of 4, is pretty well neutralized by making those districts eligible for equity revenue. The equity revenue does vary some among the three districts because of the different sizes of the referendums, but it is approximately the same order of magnitude in terms of the increase to those districts from the equity revenue coming in as kind of the effect of eliminating the TRA, but they're not benefiting from that. At the other end of the formula, the ultimate effect is that all districts are guaranteed at least a $199 per pupil increase over what they would have been receiving in the second year under the 2% increase formula that's the governor's recommending for the first year. And so some of some of those differences between the 3% and the 4% end up going into the transition formula, but I maybe could explain that better as I get a little further into the discussion here.
Now, can you fully explain that?
Let me summarize it.
It's
you know,
more than it sounds.
I think we'll try to move along here because we're barely into this budget, right?
You did a good job.
We're almost through.
We're almost through? We're on page 9. All right, let's roll.
Madam Chair, Governor's recommending a 2% increase in the general education formula for the second year of the biennium. In order to convert the current formula, which is an amount per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, to an amount per actual current year student, the calculations were done to look at how many total dollars are currently being expended in the basic formula and how many dollars are actually being expended after we net out the $47 million that's eliminated because of the TRA adjustment. So basically you take about $4.35 billion that goes into the basic formula before the TRA adjustment. You net out $47 million that's currently being taken away from districts through the TRA adjustment. And then you put over on the side the funding for the secondary enrollment and the declining enrollment, and you take the total amount of money that's actually available there and divide that by the number of students, and you get $4,986 per student. So $4,986 per student is the equivalent of $4,601 under the current structure. And if you then just take the 4986 and you increase that by 2% for the first year, another 2% for the second year, you arrive at the formula allowance that the governor's recommending, which is $5,188 per actual student. So this is a real 2% increase in the second year of the biennium. As I said, there are variations around that average that are primarily attributable to the change in terms of eliminating the TRA as a separate adjustment factor. Another recommendation the governor is making is to replace a number of miscellaneous property tax levies with a $150 per pupil discretionary levy. And the new discretionary levy would be equalized by the state with an equalizing factor of $6,900 per pupil. That's roughly the state average. About half the districts would receive equalization aid. The other half of the districts would not receive equalization aid. On the average, that's an increase of $76 per pupil over the amount that districts are currently receiving from the miscellaneous levies that are being repealed. The increase in excess of $76 per pupil would be subject to this turbocharged reverse referendum process that is being developed by the Department of Revenue that would apply not only to school levies but also to city and county levies. It does not apply to the entire discretionary levy. It only applies to the increase over $76 per student. So for the district that's currently receiving the state average for these programs, the $74 per student, they would be able to receive the $76 increase up to the $150 without a turbocharged reverse referendum. If you had a district that had none of these levies right now, they would be getting a $150 increase over current law. The first $76, they would not be required to have a turbocharged reverse referendum on. But for that additional increase over and above the state average of $76, there would be this requirement for the reverse referendum. There would also be a guarantee provided through this that if the district was currently receiving more than the average amount from these levies that have been repealed, that they would be receiving transition revenue to make up the difference. So in effect, there's a guaranteed minimum increase of $76 per student for every district in the state through this process. The repealed levies, the levies that the governor is recommending to repeal, include the reemployment insurance levy, the judgment levy, the safe schools levy, the operating portion of the building lease levy, the ice arena levy, the tree growth replacement levy, the swimming pool levy, lost interest earning levy, severance levy, and a couple of miscellaneous local provisions that only apply to a couple of school districts in the state.
Mr. Melcher, or Commissioner Segrin, for instance, safe schools. Right now, districts spend a certain amount to keep, or whatever it is they do to keep their schools safe. Will they have to do that, or could they just not do that at all?
Madam Chair and members, this discretionary levy proposal, the dollars under this program would be discretionary. It would be up to the school board to determine how to use those. So if they chose to continue using $27 per pupil for safe schools, they could do that. If they decided they wanted to use part of the increase to raise that to $50, they could do that. Or if they decided they didn't need to spend the full $27, they would also have that choice.
I don't think I ever did quite understand what the tree growth replacement levy was, but Representative Heidgerken.
That answered. Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, last year we cut like 5% from the different levies, I believe. If you take that into account, if we restored that, then how much of that $76 would really be an increase over 2002?
Madam Chair and Representative Mr. Melcher. That's a good question. I don't have the exact answer to that, but I believe that there would still be a substantial increase. I think it was a 10% reduction as opposed to 5%. We went to 90% rather than 10. But the reduction to those levies, and Mr. Strom or Mr. Crowe might have more exact numbers than I do, was substantially less than the roughly $75 million of new authority that's being provided here. I think it was an order of magnitude of like $10 million or something.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. Melcher, Representative Bernardi, yeah, I think in total, if you added the lease levy and the roughly $3 million on safe schools, you'd get a number around $15 million or thereabouts, or about between $15 and $20 per kid as opposed to $76.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Go ahead, Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, the governor is also recommending changes in the school district operating referendum revenue. The first change would be to adjust the referendum allowances for the change in pupil unit calculation. So if a school district had passed a $500 referendum levy per resident marginal cost pupil unit, we would recalculate what that dollar value was based on the actual number of students in the current year. So that might typically be, let's say, at a $500 per resident marginal cost pupil unit levy, that might be $550 per actual student. And those would be converted, and that would ensure that districts would receive the same amount of money from the referendum as they're currently receiving. It would just be on a little more understandable basis. Governor's also recommending to increase the standard referendum cap from 18.6% of the general education formula to 28% of the general education formula. In round numbers, that would increase the standard cap from roughly $1,000 per unweighted student to about $1,500 per unweighted student. It's about a $500 increase. It's not sufficient to totally eliminate the grandfathering that we have for districts that had relatively high referendums in 1994. We currently have 12 districts that have a grandfathered referendum cap based on the level of referendum that they had in 1994. This would reduce the number down to 7 districts that would still have referendums that are in excess of the standard referendum, and they would include Hopkins, St. Louis Park, Edina. I don't have the complete list in front of me, but what this will do is substantially narrow the gap between the cap that those districts have and the cap that other districts have. And quite often, those are next-door neighbors. For example, Eden Prairie is subject to the standard cap now. Edina has a cap that's $500 or $600 higher. Same kind of thing exists in other parts of the metropolitan area. Another change that the governor is recommending is that the cap for the 1994 grandfather districts continue to be inflated based on the consumer price index. Under current law, those districts receive inflation based on the consumer price index through 2008, and then their level of growth is reduced to one quarter of the formula increase. Finally, the governor is recommending that Tier 2 referendum equalization be extended to 28% of the formula allowance up to the new cap, so that districts with low property value would have access to equalization money if they were to pass a referendum above the current cap level. In the area of equity revenue, we currently have two fairly complicated formulas, one for the metropolitan area, one for the rural areas of the state. The metropolitan districts receive more money per student from the equity formula than the rural districts do currently. The current formula is based on the 95th percentile of revenue per student in the metropolitan area, and also the 95th percentile of revenue per student in the rural area. The current formula excludes Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth from qualifying for this revenue. It also excludes districts that do not have a referendum, except from a portion of the revenue. Under the governor's recommendation, we would, again, in the general spirit of moving toward more uniform, more transparent formulas, the governor is recommending that we have a single statewide formula that would apply to all school districts in the state, including Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and including districts that do not have a referendum. This would also target more of the equity dollars to those districts that have relatively low revenue per student. Currently, the formula has two aspects. There's a flat $13 per student allocation that goes to all districts that are below the 95th percentile, and then the rest of the money is allocated based on a sliding scale that provides up to $75 per student on a sliding scale. The governor's recommendation is to put all of that money into the sliding scale so that a higher percentage of the dollars are targeted to the districts that have relatively low revenue per student. The next slide deals with the alternative compensation revenue for the second year of the biennium. This is essentially the same formula as we discussed for the first year. The only change is this would be partly funded with state aid and partly funded with levy. The governor is recommending that beginning in 07, the alternative compensation formula include a $155 amount that would be entirely state aid and a $70 per pupil equalized levy. The total revenue available, or the total basic aid, the $155 piece available to school districts in the second year would be about $62 million, and that's funded with the $50 million increase plus the $3.7 million dollars in the current formula, and then there's an adjustment for the 81-19 funding mechanism. Other general education changes that are being recommended. We had a discussion earlier about transportation sparsity, and the governor is recommending a change in the transportation sparsity formula to update the model for newer data. The current transportation sparsity formula goes back to 1994 data that was used during the 1995 legislative session when the transportation was rolled into the general education program. Since that time, we've had changes in transportation costs, and they haven't been uniform. What we've seen, actually, is more rapid increases in transportation costs in rural districts than we have in the metropolitan area, where the cost per student is affected more heavily due to declining enrollment and gas prices as it relates to the budgets in those communities. And so what the recommendation here does is essentially changes the slope of the line and effectively provides a higher level of funding for transportation costs in the rural areas where the average cost has grown more rapidly over the last 7 or 8 years. The governor is also recommending that a 2% inflation be provided on the D-Link formulas in the second year of the biennium. And finally, the governor is recommending that the transition revenue be recalculated to guarantee that every district in the state will receive an increase of at least $199 per student in the second year of the biennium over what they would have received under the formula that the governor is recommending for the first year of the biennium. So, in other words, the first year of the biennium, everybody gets a 2% increase. There aren't any structural changes. What this says is basically, in addition to that 2% increase you got in the first year, after all is said and done with these formula changes, you will get at least $199 per pupil increase in the second year of the biennium. That includes basically $102 on the basic formula, the $76 in the discretionary, and the $21 average increase that is attributable to the 2% increase for the other formulas that are linked. So this is quite different than the transition calculation that we did 2 years ago. We're not going back and looking at the prior year, so we won't have districts that are falling through the cracks on that piece of it.
Oh, Representative Bernardi. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Mr. Melchert looked over at me when he said that. So thank you for fixing that glitch for this time, but we still haven't fixed the glitch that happened last time. Is there a way we can correct it? I don't want the answer to be, I'll just let you know that you can use part of that discretionary formula to make it up, because actually my school district probably wouldn't make it up. So what I want to know, can we fix that glitch? You're allowing all, and I don't even know if my school district can afford to levy for it anymore because of all these new additional levies. So they're getting back to me and letting me know if they can even levy. So I'm wondering, can you guys do a supplemental budget and propose that that's something that should be fixed, because you realize that, you know, it's something that was unfair, and that there are school districts out there that are not guaranteed their 2002 classroom dollars, because that you supplanted compensatory dollars for unrestricted classroom dollars. You know what I'm talking about. But I think that's the best option. And the second option is at least turn those compensatory dollars that were supplanted with our unrestricted dollars, at least make those guaranteed dollars so that we can't go below our 2002 levels of funding. That would be the second option.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher probably can't answer that question. You know, he's just following the instructions of whoever. We have noted your concern, and, you know, we will certainly, we need to do an analysis of how much it would cost statewide for that, and probably Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, and Mr. Melcher can put their heads together to see what the impact would be on the levy. Again, you know, if you have a situation where you may be concerned about levy increases, that might be an issue to discuss with your school district too, because it would be another increase. But we certainly can look into it.
I think Mr. Strom does have an estimate. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, we need to make sure we're using sort of the final compensatory data that was used for that year, but I suspect we can nearly fix that entire issue with about $5 million per year, just to give the committee members some idea of the relative magnitude of what we'd be looking at.
And, Madam Chair, may I have a comment on that?
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to put this in perspective, we lost out on $5 million of aid last year because we would have gotten that in aid. And then now it would be a levy, because it would be a $5 million levy increase. It wouldn't be any aid, correct?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, the what-if is always difficult, because if assuming we had the target we had for last year, if the $5 million had been there, it wouldn't have been somewhere else. And so the question is where it would have been to make the difference. The transition revenue in fiscal year 2004 was all aid, but in fiscal year 2005 it was a mix of aid and levy. So if we had done it right away in 2003, by fiscal year 2005, in the second year, it would have been a mix of aid and levy, and it would have probably been slightly more heavy levy for those districts, given the distribution of where the revenue was.
Okay, and Madam Chair, just to put it in perspective, may I? In my school district, thank you, Madam Chair, we lost out at $80 per pupil that every other school district in the state would have realized in any other year had it not happened. Our increase in poverty had been that year. So had it happened a year earlier or a year later, we would have gotten about $80 per pupil. Some other districts, like Plummer, it was over $100 per pupil. Bemidji, it was, $50 to $80 per pupil. Whatever. It was the districts with growing poverty in the state of Minnesota. So it was inner ring suburban districts as well as rural districts across the state. And all we're asking is to guarantee us our 2002 classroom dollars and allow us to realize our increase that we should have received for having a growing poverty in our district.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, like to move to the next slide. Changes in reserve requirements. The governor is eliminating that the requirements for reserve revenue for learning and development be eliminated. The governor is also recommending that districts be allowed to count expenditures from staff development reserve fund balances toward the 2% staff development set-aside requirement. Special education funding. The governor is recommending that special education regular revenue be increased by 4% in fiscal year 07 and an additional 4% in fiscal 08, and that increase would be funded with an equalized property tax levy that would be equalized at $6,900 per pupil. The governor is also recommending in the special education funding area that most excess cost aid be allocated based on the prior year's data. School districts have an incredible amount of difficulty budgeting for excess cost aid because of the uncertainty. Quite often they don't know how much they're going to get until 6 months after the year is over. By using the prior year's data as a basis for calculating the current aid, they would have a lot more budget certainty in terms of how many dollars they'll be getting for special education excess cost aid. And finally, the governor is recommending that the process for special education tuition billing be standardized and simplified. What the department would like to do over a two-year period is move away from a process where the districts are required to spend an enormous amount of time doing calculations of special education tuition bills, and instead to have the department do those calculations and make an adjustment on special education aid payments to school districts. Currently, the department is required to provide a uniform form or methodology for the school districts to use, but the school districts are responsible for doing all of these calculations, and there are thousands of these bills that need to be done. Most of the data that's needed to calculate the special education tuition bills is already submitted to the department, and by just simply using that data, the department can perform that task much more efficiently and also can eliminate some of the problems. And there have been a lot of problems in terms of the accuracy and the timeliness of the special education tuition bills. We know that some school districts actually hire full-time staff who simply review special education tuition bills coming in from other districts, and they pay for themselves by catching errors that are made. And we think that there's a better way to do that. We're still in the process of developing the specific details and testing out kind of what the impacts would be on districts. But we would like to recommend it that we move forward with that. In the area of facilities funding, we have a long-standing equity issue between the very large districts in the state that qualify for alternative facilities funding and all of the other districts in the state that do not qualify for that funding. And the governor is recommending a first step in the direction of addressing that equity issue be taken by allowing districts that are not eligible for the alternative bonding funding to receive an equalized levy at $50 per pupil if those districts have buildings that are at least 35 years old on average. And if the buildings are newer than that, they would receive a proportionately reduced amount. Governor is also recommending to eliminate another equity issue that's come up with the maximum effort tax rate to adjust the tax rate from 32% to 28% to correct a calculation that was done at the time of the 2001 property tax reform, which resulted in a substantial increase in the actual tax burdens for districts that have maximum effort tax levies. In the area of telecommunications funding, the governor is coming back with a proposal that he recommended last year and that was included in the House bill last year that would provide funding for 90% of the cost of telecommunication access adjusted for E-rate discounts exceeding $15 per student. So this money would be targeted primarily to rural districts that have relatively high costs for telecommunication access because of their isolated rural location and the higher fees that they have to pay for access to telecommunications. In fiscal 07, the formula would be adjusted slightly to have a subtraction of $18 per unweighted student rather than $15 per weighted student, just to keep the dollars even. In the area of transportation funding, the governor's recommending that the school districts that have Carpenter school buses with defective wells would be allowed to levy up to $30,000 for replacement of those buses. That's a provision that was included in the House bill last year as well. The governor is also recommending that the cost allocations for pupil transportation be standardized and limited. We've noticed a trend over the past few years for districts to charge significant additional indirect costs to transportation. For example, charging a percentage of teacher salaries for time that teachers might spend walking students out to the bus, or charging a percentage of the superintendent's time and the principal's time and the school secretary's time and other sorts of things to transportation. And that affects the special education funding, because a portion of that gets allocated into the special education formula, and the net effect is that we're reducing the percentage reimbursements that otherwise provide for special education teachers and school bus drivers and others that are providing more direct services for transportation. We also have a lot of variation among districts in the extent to which they're doing these cost allocations. So by limiting the amount of those indirect costs that can be charged to transportation, it will simplify some of the paperwork and also make the allocations more uniform across the state. The governor is also recommending that school districts be allowed to charge depreciation on special education buses in the calculation of special education base revenue. Currently, if you lease special education buses, the cost for leasing is included, but if you own special education buses, the depreciation is not included. It creates an incentive, basically, for districts to lease the buses, even if that costs more. This, we think, will create some cost savings by treating leased buses and district-owned buses in a similar fashion. In addition, the governor's recommending that the cost of transporting homeless students not in shelters, where they're transported from one district to another, be included in the special education transportation cost. While these students are not necessarily disabled students, the costs are very similar. Under current law, homeless students that are in shelters are counted in the disabled category. Homeless students that are not in shelters are not counted. So this will, again, kind of even up the playing field. Another recommendation is that where we have transportation of homeless students across district lines, that the school district enrolling the child would be responsible for transportation unless the two districts agree. Currently, we're making the district where the shelter is located responsible, and that can create some problems in terms of the alignment of the transportation. It's much more efficient for the district that's enrolling the kids and busing other kids to that location to go into the other district to pick up the kids than for a district to transport kids across district lines the other direction. Another change the governor is recommending is that we create a new entity called administrative districts that would be aimed at increasing the efficiency of administrative services while maintaining the local school board control over the management and the continued operation of individual buildings. This would require either five districts or three districts with at least 5,000 students or 2,000 square miles. Basically, those districts could get together, hire one superintendent for the overall group, perhaps have one business office, one food service operation, one transportation operation, but to still maintain control over the actual operation of the individual school buildings with the individual schools. And that would avoid the problem of a consolidation where there's a fear that small school is going to be shut down because of the consolidation. So we're trying to get the best of both worlds, where there would be some administrative efficiencies, but to maintain the local control over the actual school building sites. And there would be a small levy for severance costs that might be associated with that.
Representative Bernard.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, Mr. Melcher, is there a reason why it has to be five districts? Because I'm thinking a number of years ago, Fridley Spring Lake Park and Columbia Heights had talked about doing this, but it doesn't look just by those that they would be able to qualify under those criteria. So I'm just wondering why.
Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, it may be that there's three districts with five, I'm not sure if they have 5,000 students between the three districts. If they do, then they would qualify under that
They have just about that many.
Or, you know, but those are just the starting point in terms of discussion, in terms of what would be appropriate.
Okay. All right, I think that's probably the end of our time, and we do have session this afternoon, or I would keep us going here for a while. So we'll have to figure out whether or not we need to get through the rest of this and when we might do that. Members, in your packets, there was, if you remember, Waseca had a rubric for evaluation, etc. That is in your packets, so now you have a copy of that. Also, has anybody had a chance to read the minutes?
I didn't.
So moved, Madam Chair. I read them.
All right. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Also, you have your budget books. And how many of you wish to take these with you? I mean, we have to figure out some way to haul them around. We don't have a cart here at the moment, but... You know, sometimes it's better for us to keep them, and if you're going to read them, however, which I might suggest you might want to read at least parts of these, it's very good reading for late at night.
Yeah.
So you may choose to take these with you, but you will only get one budget book, so we'll try to kind of warn you, put your name in it or something, we'll try to warn you in advance when we're going to need it, and maybe we can put something in it. We'll try to put, then, if your names are in them, we'll try to put your name somewhere on the binder so that we can find your books. So any notes that you're making in them will be preserved for you. So with that, we'll see you next Tuesday. Meeting is adjourned.